Recovering Sanity by Edward Podvill, MD, published 2003, Appendix 1, Psychotherapy. Psychotherapy as an expression of the spiritual journey based on the experience of shunyata. Although the practice of intensive individual psychotherapy had been at the center of my life for many years, when I wrote the first edition of this book, I said almost nothing about it. Psychotherapy was also a large part of my work in the Windhorse Project, and my particular expression of it continued to mature. But at the time of writing, it was far more important and urgent for me to give the recipe and technology for Windhorse Environmental Therapy, which was by then my overriding concern and the direct result of my own and my colleagues' Buddhist practice and study. There was also the political problem that the discipline of psychotherapy with severely disturbed people was disappearing due to the widespread belief that the so-called antipsychotic medications had made personal therapy unnecessary. But when a few years later the Windhorse group asked me to write something to help train new psychotherapists, I decided to share the wisdom of the special lineage in which I was trained and to give some basic instructions that were becoming more clear to me when integrated with intensive Buddhist meditation. This new writing opportunity makes me very happy because now I finally have the correct place to acknowledge my appreciation, indebtedness, and profound respect for those who trained and inspired me to work with people who were lost in their madness. Foremost among these teachers, I'm grateful to Dr. Harold F. Searles, whose work and essential teachings I have done my best to transmit in the following few pages. Body, Speech, and Mind of Psychotherapy, Environmental Relationship, and Subtle Energies, Beginnings. There have always been bursts of compassionate concern to care for people overcome with the disorders of the mind. But only as recently as 100 years ago did that inspiration and energy come together to create an intimate personal treatment now known as the psychoanalytic movement. Its most enduring heritage is the development of the skills of intensive psychotherapy, which flourished for a while, but now seem to have given way to a bewildering variety of short-term therapies, none of which have the depth and discipline for people who are or are becoming insane. For this reason, I wish to discuss some principles of psychotherapy and how they relate to the practice of mindfulness, awareness, meditation, and how an understanding of the two disciplines can allow the energy of compassion to re-energize our healing traditions. Sigmund Freud and his earliest students worked to some extent with people in extreme states of mind. They even envisioned treatment communities, although we know very little about them. Eugene Bleuler and Carl Jung of the Bergholtzi Hospital in Zurich attempted to do psychotherapy right on the psychiatric hospital wards. In the late 1920s, near Berlin, a small psychoanalytic hospital called Tegel was actually founded under the direction of Ernest Simmel, which Freud would sometimes visit in the summers. One of my first psychoanalytic supervisors, Dr. Edith Weigert, who was in training at the time, told us about the bucolic life at Tegel and how, as a student, she had taken a silent walk with Freud in the surrounding countryside, silent because Freud was already suffering from throat cancer and carefully guarded his voice so he could continue to speak with patients. In my imagination, I always saw Tegel as something like the sanatorium of Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. Like Mann, Edith Weigert and her husband fled the impending disaster in Germany in the 1930s and immigrated to the United States, to Washington, D.C. There she met up with another recent immigrant from Berlin, a woman who in more ways than one is at the very heart of the treatment of those who suffer with psychosis, Dr. Frieda Fromm Reichman. A close collaboration took place between them, which later included several studies of manic depressive psychosis. But more important, Frieda Fromm Reichman managed to transform Chestnut Lodge on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., from a sanatorium for alcoholic recovery into a world-renowned center for intensive psychotherapy of people in extreme states of mind. Dr. Harry Stack Sullivan, nearby in Baltimore, also struggled to establish a treatment ward for people with psychosis at Shepherd Pratt Hospital, frequently came to Chestnut Lodge to teach and supervise. Fromm Reichman became deeply influenced by his ideas and work. These people were some of the founding members of the newly formed Washington Psychoanalytic Training Institute, and it became the only such training facility to bear the influence of therapists doing intensive psychotherapy with highly disturbed patients. It gave a distinctive flavor to the training, and as one of my teachers there used to say, referring to Sullivan's pervasive influence, we all have a touch of the Irish in us. But in fact, the Institute was considered somewhat heretical by the mainstream psychoanalytic orthodoxy. Fromm Reichman herself came under strong attack for her psychoanalytic application to treating psychotic people. In spite of her almost legendary gentleness and concern for people, she was also quite tough and resilient. Soon after her medical training in Germany, she had been conscripted into the army during World War I and worked in a field hospital on the front lines treating soldiers with head wounds. At Chestnut Lodge Hospital, she lived in a small cottage on the hospital grounds and so worked with her therapy patients in her own home. I've always been impressed by this gracious attitude expressed, I think, by her remark that when she works with patients, it is with a sense of inviting a guest into her living room. When I began my personal psychoanalysis with Dr. Harold Searles in 1963, he was a senior staff therapist at Chestnut Lodge. His office was in the same cottage in which Fromm Reichman had lived. And I was aware that the first year and a half of my psychoanalysis was taking place in her bedroom. Although I never met Fromm Reichman, who died in the mid-1950s, I've always felt indebted to her. When I was a young resident in psychiatry at Stanford University in 1962, I had a supervisor who had worked at Chestnut Lodge and trained under Fromm Reichman. He gave me her article called On Loneliness, which deeply affected me by its humility, courage, and lack of technical jargon. I liked that article so much that he gave me another one by Harold Searles called The Urge to Drive Another Person Crazy. At this time, what impressed me was the fearlessness to use every aspect of one's mind in the service of the therapeutic process. It was just that kind of courage that I realized I wanted to learn in order to work with my own life and to live it more fully. The next year, when I moved to Washington, D.C. to do brain research at the National Institute of Mental Health, I wrote to Searles requesting to become his patient. Throughout this time, I had very little feeling that I could really help people. In spite of my training, the family medical heritage and family medical heritage, so the laboratory seemed like the best place for me. But after about 2 years of analysis with Searles, enough confidence developed in me so that before I turned 30, I decided to take the leap and become a student at the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute. A year later, I joined the therapy staff at Chestnut Lodge Hospital. Then the analysis with Searles became a training analysis lasting 7 years. That period also became a kind of apprenticeship or transmission in the art and science of psychoanalysis. Dr. Otto Will, my main supervisor at Chestnut Labs, whom I later went to work with when he became director of the Austin Riggs Center, had been in training analysis with both Harold Stack Sullivan and Frieda Fromm Reichman. He was generally considered to be the active holder of their psychoanalytic tradition. At this time, the work at Chestnut Lodge was one of total immersion in intensive psychotherapy, seeing 6 hospitalized patients 4 times a week, group supervision twice a week, twice weekly case conferences, as well as all the therapy work, supervision, and study required for Psychoanalytic Institute training. During those 9 years that I worked at Chestnut Lodge, the intensive psychotherapy of acutely and chronically psychotic people was at the center of my life. At Chestnut Lodge and at a few other hospital institutions where intensive individual therapy was offered, the care of the patient was usually divided between the individual psychotherapists and an administrative therapist. At Chestnut Lodge, the term therapist-administrator split was coined to describe the strict division between functions and responsibilities, as well as the conflicts that arose between them, the intention being to leave the individual therapist free from the daily and more mundane concerns of the patient's life within the hospital. In other words, the psychotherapy was of the highest importance, the real agent of recovery, and the administrative and nursing work done on the wards was simply expected to provide a good container in which the individual therapy could take place with as few obstacles as possible. In the Windhorse Project, the psychotherapist has no such luxury, or rather no such insulation from the earth qualities of the patient's life, of a patient's life. Certainly the team leader is more involved with managing the household and the team, but the principal therapist is never removed from these activities and decisions. Of course, there is a natural hierarchy within a Windhorse team, but even though the individual psychotherapist is the director, followed by the team leader, then the team therapists, and finally the housemates, everyone really knows that the whole therapy situation hinges on the work of the housemates. The Windhorse team is a network of individuals, all in their own specific relationships with the patient, and it is the totality of these that creates the therapeutic home. The individual psychotherapist simply does his or her own particular job, but whatever role a therapist has, the principles of basic attendance are the foundation of the work one does. See Chapter 6. Invitation. Compared to Windhorse intensive psychotherapy, the usual psychotherapy seemed secretive, technical, and overly precious. Of course, there are reasons given for such preciousness, such as preserving the purity of the transference upon which so much of psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy is said to depend. But in the case of Windhorse therapy, when working with people in extreme states of mind, it is the earthiness, openness, and genuineness of communication that carries the transformative power. The quality of openness is noteworthy. For example, at team meetings, the team therapists might be curious about the psychotherapy, or they might make suggestions about problems that could be addressed. And as well known, how other team members may at times be more significant to the patient than the designated psychotherapist without it becoming a competitive situation. Or the therapist might even find him or herself actually doing a kind of co-therapy with another team member. Once one of our patients, after having done very well, suddenly entered an acute crisis, becoming fixed in a hallucinatory world and completely out of contact, except for an atmosphere of impending violence. The team leader, Jeff Fortuna, was with the patient at that time and feeling helpless and dejected. He called me on the phone for any advice or support I could give. Since I had no idea what to say, I went over to the patient's home. The patient was huddled in the corner of his bed in his disheveled room and relating to nothing other than unseen presences. Jeff and I tried to talk with him together. It was useless. Possibly the presence of the two of us threatened him and drove him even further back into his impenetrable thought world. I recall a moment of just giving up. I turned my attention to Jeff and realized that I hadn't spoken alone to him for some time about anything other than work. Since at that time we might as well have been alone, I started to talk to him about very personal matters, about my life, his life, our relationships. Somehow we got quite involved talking to each other, simply ignoring the patient's presence. He could be part of it if he liked, or if not, that was fine also. And we were thoroughly enjoying our conversation and sometimes laughing. What a relief from the intensity of wanting something from the patient. The conversation was getting interesting, sometimes sexy, provocative, gossipy, humorous. Of course, who could resist eavesdropping on this? Gradually, the patient attended to us. Maybe he found our world more interesting than the one he was stuck in, or he was curious about our lives, or simply jealous. Who knows? Little by little, without the least attempt on our part to seduce him, he began to join our conversation. This was not any particular triumph on our part, but it was for the patient. An unusual experience of being able to break loose from his thought world without having to be outrageous or violent. In a way, this episode was simply a variation on the theme of basic attendance, which is one of the many reasons why A. Windhorst's intensive psychotherapist, or a potential one, should ideally first train in the discipline of basic attendance. And at the heart of all basic attendance is a discipline called exchanging oneself for others, Tung Lin, see pages 270 to 271. It is not so easy to do. It takes some effort. Sometimes it seems to come quite naturally. At other times, it seems impossible. It means relaxing one's grip on one's own territory, one's self-righteousness, authority, professional pride, even one's own sense of health or well-being, and accepting into oneself the depression or panic, the resentment, abandonment, and confusion of the person you are relating to. This is really relating, and there is no ulterior motive for doing this, no intent to manipulate or manage the other person. It is not necessarily that some boundaries or barriers are breaking down, but more like an opening into a freely moving and interpenetrating basic humanity. This is what is meant by authentic therapeutic relationship. Of course, for the most of us, this kind of exchange is not very stable and so needs to be developed. That development begins to happen quickly once one has made the discovery of a basic fearless clarity within oneself, but it can also be practiced in a very simple way. A master of this particular meditation discipline used to say, "If someone says your teacup is in my space, I just move my teacup away." That says it all. The teacup metaphor means that our relationships with people constantly present opportunities to give in, relinquish fixed ideas of ourself, of who we are, and all the countless little territories that we spend our lives protecting. That is, we free ourselves from becoming caught up in who is right or wrong, or who is to blame, and so we can look beyond that to see what the other person really needs. What happens within the relationship between the patient and the therapist is the fuel of energy source of therapy. Of course, there is some investigation of the past, one's personal history. People love to talk about their history, almost obsessed by how they become the way they are. It seems to be a coin of the realm, the key to one's sense of identity. But no matter what one talks about, there is a continuous stream of interaction taking place between the patient and the therapist that goes on both in and out of awareness. As soon as you start talking to someone about who you are or have been, about your parents, your accomplishments or failures, your love life, the dream you had last night, in the middle of it, in between the lines, between the words, there is another stream of subconscious commentary, perhaps only barely observable to oneself, that busily anticipates and prepares for the reaction of the listener. Behind it all, one is judging one's own words and thoughts as good or bad, healthy or unhealthy. And these little particles of judgment that are then quickly projected into, attributed to the other person. Even in the most simple forms of communication, there is the possibility for more subtle levels of observation. It lies within the scope of the intensive psychotherapy discipline to open up these areas of observation, or at least invite such observation. When this can happen, it leads to increasingly greater precision at seeing one's mind in relationship, and along with this, there is a gradual sharpening of one's outer sensory perceptions and general intelligence as well. From the very beginning of the psychoanalytic experiment, the first therapist gave this invitation: you are completely free to say anything and everything that comes into your mind. It is just this openness and hospitality that has become the hallmark of intensive psychotherapy. It is an invitation that a therapist might make over and over again in words and attitude. It is well known this led to the technique called free association. At first, this technique was applied to the investigation of dreams, which by their very nature could not be approached directly, but only obliquely through one's uncensored spontaneous speech. Then it was found to be useful in exploring all opaque mental phenomena, such as symptoms of any kind, fears, obsessions, addictions, and so on. At some point, free association became simply a standard practice in intensive psychotherapy. My own experience of doing this as a patient was quite vivid at first. It seemed an impossible burden to express whatever thoughts came into my mind without holding them back, without censoring or editing. At best, I could only express a small fragment of it all, with only occasional sudden eruptions like, "This is ridiculous. What am I doing here?" But Searles always seemed patient, at most only gently urging me to continue, and he seemed able to work with whatever I might say, no matter how little it was. Sometimes I just could not give in to the technique. I could not let go into the nonsense of it, and the system would just jam and I would fall back into silence. I had to ask myself, what was the cause of this resistance? Sometimes it was simply the negativity toward the whole process that I felt too embarrassed to express, but mostly and more profoundly, I thought at the time, it had to do with having to face the utter banality of my mind. What was in my mind was boring, petty, tiresome, uninteresting, even sickening, a cycle of useless concerns. Whatever thought I looked at appeared as some form of self-justification, comparing myself to others, subtly trying to repair myself, secure myself this, myself that. In the end, the whole thought process seemed driven by vanity and its endless "I can't go on with it" attitude. Certainly, I thought this must be the origin of some forms of mutism. At some point in all this, I lost all respect for my discursive mind. Then there were other times when it was easy and I could just prattle on taking an almost manic delight in banality, at ease with the whole thought system being inconsequential and empty and even vastly humorous. Several years later, I discovered all this again in much more detail when I began the practice of mindfulness sitting meditation. It was quite a surprise. There it was again, the fragile pride, the self-righteousness behind the whole display. But this time the method of being with this inevitable phenomenon was very difficult. When someone is in an extreme state of mind, when under the pressure of great speed of associations, or in a continual state of mindless distraction, then the method of free association will be useless. But still, the invitation exists in the atmosphere as an openness to freedom of expression and potentially a space in which one can relax. The invitation also has its crucial counterpart in the way the therapist works with his or her own mind. The practice here is to listen to anything that is expressed without labeling it or diagnosing it as meaning this or that. It is a complementary letting go of any judgment about what one is hearing, thus relaxing a reflex attempt to assign meaning. This is ideally the way one could listen to another person recount the dream he or she had last night. One could listen without analysis or interpretation, with just a naked receptivity, itself almost dreamlike, while one's own associations to the dream imagery spontaneously come and go. Usually this is something that therapists have to practice before they can reach this degree of relaxation, of not having to respond. It is helpful just to listen to people describe their dreams with no attempt to make anything out of them, but simply to be with them and appreciate the texture of dream apparition and the quality of emotions that give the dreams their energy. The hospitality of the invitation is the basic ground of the intensive psychotherapy relationship, a meaning at the most ordinary of levels. It is before diagnosis, investigation, analysis, or even the urge to be useful or helpful. It is from this simplicity that trust and mutual respect can spring. This basic level of relatedness, perhaps a combination of being present and letting in, see pages 267 to 271, is one of the meanings of Harry Stack Sullivan's famous dictum, "We are all just more simply human than otherwise." Emotions. In psychotherapy with people who do not have much control over their minds and are at the mercy of their emotions, sometimes just a recognition and clear delineation of an emotion is the first step in the discovery that mind can be worked with and tamed at all. There are a great many different ideas and theories about how a therapist should relate to a patient's expression of emotions in the course of psychotherapy, but practically speaking, whatever idea one has of emotions, how a therapist relates to his or her own emotions is what leads the way in therapy, especially when working with highly disturbed people, as Sullivan from Reichman advise. One cannot simply be an impassive interlocutor or benevolent witness. One needs to be fully engaged. Vitality. Searles makes his own position very clear. Quote, "It was only in the realm of feeling that I found aliveness and interest, and on the basis of too many years of personal experience with thought and personality structure as being defenses against spontaneous emotion, I reacted to these as being basically inert and hostile to life," unquote. In my own therapeutic work with him, he seemed to have patience with whatever I talked about, but whenever I became conceptual or removed from what I was saying, he would always point at that. He did not in any way exhort me to express or discharge emotions, nor did he seem to place a higher value on them than anything else. To me, he seemed relentless in exposing an absence of feeling or an incongruous feeling and the possible lack of courage with which I kept them hidden from myself as well as from him. He did not formulate his approach to emotions into any kind of technique, only that, quote, in working with a chronically schizophrenic patient or anyone else, I can add, always I find the therapist's openness to various feelings of whatever sort to be the key to the solution, unquote. In this sense, the therapist's whole range of thoughts and emotions, alertness or drowsiness, interest or disinterest, sadness or delight, hope or fear, and so on, is the palette that he or she constantly scans and that becomes the source of energy and vitality for being in relationship. At a more subtle level, one's emotional experience as well as instant mental dramas and body sensations are often found to be exactly what are missing from the patient's own expression, as if split off from the patient's awareness and experience only by the therapist. Certainly, experienced only by the therapist. Certainly, it also happens in the other direction. This is one sign of the continual ebb and flow of interpenetrating exchange between therapist and patient and among people in general. An understanding of this silent but ubiquitous phenomenon of just barely conscious exchange or free flow of emotions elevates to the highest priority of therapy the therapist's recognition and acknowledgement of his or her own emotions. Searles concluded, quote, as I have become more and more deeply convinced that I, in keeping with my fellow human beings, am a basically loving and constructively oriented person rather than a basically malevolent and destructive one, I feel increasingly free to interact, whether in a subjectively loving or subjectively malevolent manner with my patients, unquote. Needless to say, this attitude requires a certain degree of confidence that one has the best interests of the other at heart, no matter what one says, that one feels sympathetic toward the other's suffering, and that one's intention, no matter how awkward or inept it might turn out to be, is to provide an opportunity for that suffering to be acknowledged and possibly alleviated. I think that this is what Frum Reichman meant when she said, and I paraphrase, there is really no such thing as a technical mistake. There can only be mistakes of the heart. Intensive psychotherapy is not such a safe and professionally rewarding relationship as is short-term counseling or advice from a benevolent elder in which the patient is respectful and thankful for one's interest, but maybe the therapist wishes for it to be like that or thinks it should be like that. Of course, every therapist goes through periods of just wanting a peaceful relationship. This could and usually does become a problem. Such safety doesn't happen in an intensive long-term relationship of any kind. Once a patient's speech becomes more liberated and the patient begins to know you quite well, he or she can say things that can stun and wound you. Perhaps they mean to punish you or defeat you or just wake you up. What is actually more of a threat to the development of therapy is withholding such emotions. In particular, Searles would zero in on any unexpressed or hidden negative emotions toward himself. By negative, I mean those emotions that come from a basic aggression, such as resentment, vindictiveness, spite, malice, or envy. He feels that the therapist should become increasingly aware of one's own tendency to form a subtle complicity with the patient to ignore such feelings and not cause problems, and so preserve the mythical therapeutic alliance. But Searle's always had a sharp eye turned in this direction because he felt the failure to acknowledge these feelings is perhaps the greatest single cause of therapeutic failure, of stifled and lifeless therapy. Basically, this may not be so easy to do if the therapist pushes for exposing these emotions or does so too soon. It may have the opposite effect and drive the patient's anger even more deeply into obscurity. Sometimes I accuse Searles of seeing aggression when there wasn't any, and I would wonder if he were being paranoid by nature or by design. Then one time the remark shot back from him, "The trouble with you is that you are not paranoid enough." More than anything else that I know of, these words shattered a certain naivete or childlike ignorance that had seemed to insulate me from other people's anger or even their criticism. Perhaps this was the first glimpse of a sharp paranoid intellect that could become available to me. When it comes to feelings of passion or love, Searles does not feel such a sense of immediacy. They will find their expression if the therapist is open to it. In any case, for Searles, at some point, at some principal level of, undifferentiated emotion, love and hate are one, and any intense and overt relatedness is, in effect, love. In long years of work with chronically ill psychotic people, he came to discover the following. Quote, "Awesome as is the intensity of the hatred which one discovers in oneself and in the patient during the course of long work with him, still more awesome to me has been the power of the basic lovingness which is unfailingly revealed if both participants find the courage to keep going forward in the face of anxiety and despair. Lightness. It is amazing how most of us hold on to emotions, cherishing them even while they consume us. It is as if their very weight and seriousness assure us that we are alive and still exist. But when we come to work with the intensity of emotions in psychotherapy, the quality of lightness eventually becomes more important. It is a more subtle level of emotional mind. At the gross or coarse level, we see that emotions can simply carry the mind away into unlimited distraction, while at a more subtle level, emotions can be experienced as a sharpness and clarity. But seeing this requires some precision and quickness. That is, one needs to train in recognizing the energy of emotions at a point before they steal the mind away. In general, this requires solitary situations and meditation disciplines to expose the more subtle aspects of mind, while at the same time developing in oneself an unwavering attention and courage to make such observations. But in the present discussion, we are working in the context of an interpersonal discipline, so we need to look directly into the psychotherapy structure and try to discover what training in observing subtle mind might still be possible. That is, how can the precision and clarity of meditation discipline be brought into the interpersonal field of observation? This whole area should, I believe, be considered an ongoing exploration by anyone doing psychotherapy. I briefly mention only the two general aspects of an outer and inner discipline. The outer discipline includes the usual instructions that a therapist gradually gives a patient, such as maintaining the session schedule, beginning and ending sessions on time, paying fees, if that is relevant,
and priority of the continuity of sessions over almost all other events in one's life, such as work, illness, or family problems. This outer discipline might also include advice not to discharge blindly toward other people emotions that belong instead in a treatment relationship, or something not to indulge overly, or sometimes not to indulge overly in discussing one's therapy with others, and of course to try to be truthful and so on, all things with the effect of focusing and concentrating the relationship. This is more than simply a practical matter. At another level, these guidelines form a structure within which a certain toughness of mind can be experienced. If therapy is to be successful, the quality of a brave mind needs to develop so that one can exert the effort to look directly at one's own defects rather than always seeing the faults of others. And in the end, it will take almost a quality of ferocity to turn away from addictions or distracting hallucinations. But as seems to be the case with every other aspect of psychotherapy, this discipline only truly transmitted by the actual conduct and is only truly transmitted by the actual conduct and behavior of the therapist. The therapist communicates the meaning of this by the strength of his or her own discipline, attending to the same details of treating each other with respect, which add up to a strong commitment to work together and a sense of trust in the efficacy of that work. Searle's own sense of intensive psychotherapy discipline was legendary among his patients. One morning I drove to his office in an ordinary office building, but could not enter because firefighters were putting out a fire near the entrance. Although I was told by a police officer that the building was almost completely evacuated, I already knew that Searle's would be there ready to begin our appointment. It wasn't until halfway through the session, when some smoke billowed through the window, that we both burst out laughing. Perhaps laughter and a sense of humor in general is a good example of the aspect of inner discipline. First, it is fair to say that until my work with Searle's, I have never laughed so much or as strongly with another person. This might seem in contradiction to the insistence of his outer discipline, but actually the strength of that discipline allows for great spontaneity and lightness. In any case, it was not unusual that we would both be laughing so hard that I could not catch my breath or talk, and he would say, while choking with laughter, "Just keep going," and then we would start laughing again. In the years to come, I have been far from being able to emulate Searle's tenacity of psychotherapy discipline, but my freedom with laughter and my refusal, even an ability to suppress hilarity and good humor, sometimes to the distress of my patients, has not left me. So it is in this combination of disciplines, of the outer discipline of a decorum that promotes mutual respect and steadfast commitment to the work, and an inner discipline of humor, lightness, and continuity, that one finds the context to train in observing more subtle levels of mind and emotions. In this way, it may become possible to attend to and appreciate the flickering, quicksilver nature of emotions. This stands in contrast to its more usual familiar opposite, the heaviness of emotions, which become dense as soon as there is any holding on to them, exploiting them, identifying with them. Then the emotion becomes painful, a disturbance unleashing waves of thoughts and self-preoccupations. For instance, what patient has not experienced disturbing feelings of love or passion for the therapist if the treatment is helpful. Or, for that matter, what child has not felt pangs of passion for a tender caregiver or a sick person in the hospital for a nurse or even a dying person toward an intimate hospice attendant? There's nothing unusual about this sudden falling in love. One's whole world is transformed brightly, and it can even rip through the veil of a chronic depression. But then a tinge of pain creeps in as one begins to hold on to it, to exult in it, because it becomes a demand, recognition, affirmation, possession, consummation, repeated consummation. Already the threat of betrayal and loss in the air. In such a way, any emotion can arise and fall without any reason and without leaving any trace. During the course of intensive psychotherapy, the whole range and repertoire of our built-in emotions can be experienced by patient and therapist toward each other. And so there are many opportunities to observe these more subtle qualities. It is the same as in any communal situation of people living intimately together. An older monk once said about living with a small group in an extended retreat, one day you love them, the next day you hate them, so what? Although there are many varieties of basic aggression and subtle or pure quality, the subtle or pure quality is sharp, penetrating, burning, inescapable. It returns again and again, like the sting and heat of a slap in the face can return days, even weeks later, the moment it is remembered. Anger doesn't let you rest. It demands attention, so it is continually wakeful. Obsessive thoughts of revenge are its lifeline. Just when you are getting exhausted by the anger, they add brilliance to the fire. A sense of dullness, of non-emotion, non-caring indifference, and a numbness toward any intrusion into one's interior is what is called the emotion of ignorance. When therapists are confronted with patients who are rooted in this style of relating to the world, they are often troubled by repeated fantasies of violence toward the patient, of doing something that might wake the patient up from lethargy and laziness, as well as save the therapist from his or her own feelings of uselessness. Similarly, when patients experience this ignorance in a therapist, they feel they might do anything outrageous to shake the therapist out of his or her professional stupor to feel something. Probably jealousy or envy is the most insidious of the emotions. Its arising is difficult to notice because one hates to admit to its existence. It is an embarrassment, so one denies it until the last minute. If someone points it out to you, you are momentarily undone, defeated, feeling inferior, and the reflex response is often a vicious counterattack. It's too bad that we have such an exaggerated and prideful response to being exposed to our own jealousy, because not being able to experience it is a huge blind spot in our own functioning. Especially in regard to spiritual practice, the failure to recognize and see the consequences of jealousy is said to destroy one's progress. For me, it seems that Searles had to lead the way to open up the pathway of envy in his own being. When once I expressed my resignation, even despair that I could make no further progress through therapy, he said that it was fine with him, that if I was making all the progress I was hoping for, he would become so increasingly envious of my health that he could not continue to work with me. Was this the first time I experienced directly someone's envy of me, or of my urge to incite someone's envy? I don't know. I can't remember. But what a paradox it was for me, because for so long I felt myself to be such a child in comparison to his emotional robustness and courage. While jealousy is difficult to recognize because of the resistance even to acknowledge its existence, pride is difficult to recognize because its all-pervasiveness makes it almost invisible. It is everywhere. If you look carefully enough, it seems to be behind every thought and action. We might spend the day feeling lighthearted and pleased with ourselves, but then it can take only the slightest insult to make it all collapse, and we spend the rest of the day justifying ourselves to ourselves, recycling through daydreams of making it come out all right, or triumphing over the one who insulted us. And it doesn't stop there. It continues in our night dreams. It was perhaps Freud's first great discovery about the functioning of dreams, that they relentlessly attempt to undo and reverse whatever ego insult or wounded pride we have experienced during the day. A hurt pride seems to be a primary impulse to activate every reflex habit at our disposal to defend ourselves. Pride is also very versatile. We are able to take pride in just about anything, failings as well as qualities, because anything can be used to secure, enhance, or glorify our always vulnerable sense of self. At a more microscopic level, there is an inexpressible fear of being without this reference point. I'm giving more emphasis to the emotion of pride, not only because it has proved to be difficult to work with or even talk about in intensive psychotherapy, but because it is one of the greatest possible obstacles in becoming able to learn from other people, and thus imprisons one in one's own view of the world. It cuts one off from other people, blocks the heart, and transforms tenderness and love into something threatening. And when one's pride escalates desperately into arrogance and the will to wield power over others, it is often a measure of just how deeply one feels threatened by terror and annihilation. Although pride may reach its heaviest and most disastrous result in the variety of egomanias and megalomanias, they all stem from the same subtle and quick origin. Just a microsecond's flicker of physical or mental well-being deteriorates as soon as one tries to hold on to it, take comfort in it, embellish it into a sense of superiority. But the therapist's own pride might be the most subtle and dangerous of all. The pride that can develop insidiously in healers of any kind is well known, although with some expertise in alleviating suffering comes respect and considerable personal power, as well as a tendency for the healer to become deluded by pride. In the case of the psychotherapist, this translates into a pride that one understands the mind of others, that one knows what is best for them, that one has the privilege of imposing one's will or prescription on them. This is the birth of what has been called asylum mentality, where true therapy ceases to exist. The therapist is unable to learn at a moment-to-moment level from his or her patients, and although they may continue to function, they are out of contact, isolated from each other. Ground, path, and fruition of psychotherapy. From despair through emptiness and exchange to the compassionate activity of basic attendance. Loneliness. The profundity of the experience of loneliness needs to be recognized and appreciated for its great potential in any healing relationship, or more simply, in anyone. This is the final legacy from Frieda Fromm Reichman in a collection of notes called On Loneliness that she had worked on for years without completing, and that we found in her desk only after she died. Now, 40 years after having been so moved and inspired on first reading this work, I'm able to understand it in a new way. The experience of the depth and variety of loneliness leads to the source of insanity, and at the same time can become a wellspring of insight and courage. Fromm Reichman observed in her patients a deep abyss of loneliness in which a natural and instinctual longing for intimacy, whether along with or independent of desire, had become so exhausted by failure that they became resigned to ultimate isolation. She believed that this state of almost non-being had become incommunicable through ordinary language, but that nevertheless it was the basic task of a psychotherapist to open up his or her own being to receive whatever despair and fear might emanate from such a person, thus nurturing and protecting a precious and fragile human contact. This was her personal invitation to therapists. But this opening in the therapist, from Reichman noted, is not so easy to achieve because a therapist's dread of recognizing a quintessential loneliness in themselves. While discussing the skills of basic attendance, I tried to examine this therapeutic opening in the section about letting in. There I use the word empathy only because it is the closest reference point to what one might experience. But the word empathy is not good enough, meaning too many different meanings and often implying no more than sympathy, which fails to get to the subtlety and deeply personal, quality of the experience. When you are attending dying people, you may begin by acknowledging the fear that the other person probably is experiencing, and you may initiate that first by noticing your own fear, your own imagined death, or even just your glimpse of fear at being in the same room with death. But hours later, you may begin to experience a sense of suffering or depression that is uniquely your own. Your experience is different from anything you could have expected. You may have had the intention of opening up to the dying person, but then it deepens and you may find yourself in a personal crisis of nausea or renunciation, so to speak. You may feel yourself in a struggle or a conflict over whether simply to keep on going, holding on to this futile life, or to let go, give it up, get out of here. This is beyond the usual meaning of empathy. The suffering has become your own, beyond imagination, tasting, or practice. Certainly one's own projections are involved, but they are part of the total environment as well, and they cannot be so very different than the experiences of the other person. Our own projections often turn out to be not so personal. In this section on basic attendance skills of being present, you already positioned yourself as being part of the environment of suffering. You accept that. In letting in, you go further and let your mind and heart resonate in its own personal way without resisting what arises in you. And therefore, your opening is an act of fearlessness. The phenomenon of being, quote, out of contact, unquote, is fundamental to the alienation and other than human quality that so many, quote, lonely, unquote, people endure. It is also at the center of true, quote, depression, unquote, as an absolute conviction that no change is possible and that it is inconceivable that it can ever come to an end. At its source is usually such a mixture of conflicting emotions, love and hate, approach and rejection, that one is virtually paralyzed. Although we might have an intimate, loving impulse to nurture such a forlorn person, we still make every effort to experience such feelings ourselves. The, quote, therapeutic ego or, quote, spiritual instructor ego, unquote, deeply rejects them. Nevertheless, when we are in intimate contact with someone so cut off, we will feel it, or the result of our rejection to it, one way or another. One extreme example of such impasse in human relations is called autism. For some years at Chestnut Lodge, I was a therapist of a man in his 30s who, at the age of 2.5, precipitously ceased his otherwise adequate development and withdrew into what seemed an impenetrable and defiantly inert state. In fact, his world was hardly sparse and meaningless, gradually, painfully going against the inertia of years of secrecy. He revealed to me his richly populated world filled with magical creations, mostly non-human creatures, chimeras, or proto-beings with which he was in incessant and varied cohabitation. He knew each being since childhood, and for each he had unpronounceable to me, had an unpronounceable to me name. His medium of contact with his private menagerie came through the weather conditions. He spent hours each day standing outside, fully absorbed in, quote, reading, unquote, the communication and communicating with cloud formations until his legs became swollen and ulcerated. In effect, his mind was totally emptied out, projected into the heavens from which appeared every imaginable creation of companionship, the ceaseless display of his thwarted yet irresistible impulse for intimacy. Bridge. We are, of course, capable of all kinds of empathic, quote, exchanges, unquote, with states of fear, hate, joy, even mania, that undercurrent of unbridled exhilaration, self-expansion, and universal connectedness. Yet it is the pain of being out of contact, of no connection, being unreachable, eternally unloved and unable to love, unable to feel another person's suffering because of being so preoccupied with one's own. This is the particular sense of degradation felt by those who seem to be unreachable or, to a lesser degree, simply, quote, loners, unquote. We do everything we can, observed Frieda Fromm Reichman, to avoid being invaded by others' seemingly alien sensations. This is a long-established habit in all of us. Some actual effort is required to overcome it. We might be taking on or taking in an undesirable burden. Thus, what is first needed is to arouse the intention to do so. We have to wish to do it. Then we learn and practice the discipline of exchanging, quote, exchanging oneself for others, unquote. Even though this practice begins only in imagination, it soon becomes uncomfortable, especially for healthcare professionals. They feel anxious about possibly doing something wrong, of not maintaining a proper, quote, professional distance, unquote. But gradually one becomes more accustomed to give out from oneself than largely unconscious empathic processes begin to blossom, and we feel joyful at creating a bridge to someone in pain and also in taking the first step to cross it. How nonsensical, or at best, what a psychological trick this practice might seem to be if it were not already available to us, already operating beyond our ordinary awareness. The practice of exchanging oneself for others is based on a continuous rhythm of movement and ebb and flow of mind and thoughts and emotions naturally, though unconsciously, occurring between us almost all of the time and probably since infancy. In my experience, Harold Searles was a master at demonstrating this ordinary and subtle interchange between people. He pointed to this phenomenon in almost every session of our 7 years of work together. I began to realize that this interpenetration of emotions was inescapable. No matter how much I tried to prevent this continuous invasion of my privacy, which may be why it took 7 years, usually it would happen in the most ordinary of ways. I might say, "I'm feeling ill today," and soon he might reply, "You're feeling ill, but you don't mention that my own voice is weak because I'm coughing so much." Or I might say, "I'm too confused to talk now," and he might ask, "As confused as I seemed to be when I could not find the right key to open my office door to begin our session, when I suddenly seemed unable to feel anything about my father's recent death," he wondered how unfeeling he might have seemed by not offering conventional condolences. Sometimes I felt a slight dizziness at this mixing, at other times a delight, a swimmer in an ocean of mutuality where loneliness did not exist. We do not have nearly as much privacy as we would like to pretend, as much as we feel ourselves to be singular, isolated, or self-sufficient. In fact, we are porous, easily entered. We contain multitudes. The ebb and flow movement between us and everything within our environment is a quality of being alive to our world, in subtle exchange with everyone and everything around us. Once, when feeling particularly inundated, I wrote, "Your body does not belong to you. It belongs to the world, which penetrates and fills weather and the air and the breath and the pollens, vapors, waters, nectars, as well as trace minerals and crystals, solar winds, long, slow gravity waves, myriads of worms and subatomic things, infra-noises, even thoughts, wishes, and the moods of others." Highlighted awareness of permeability is experienced frequently during hallucinogenic intoxication, as if subtle channels of communication were opened for the world to cross into oneself. Sometimes it is felt when in love or during intense grief or during a singular intensity of penetrative insight, such as Goethe sometimes experienced. There is no outside and no inside. Everything without is within. Everything within is without. And when such experiences occurred during psychotherapy, some therapists were led to call into question any idea of a fixed or unique identity. Loneliness, they began to understand, could even be a low-level background of grief at the loss of a unique, continuous sense of self. Harry Stack Sullivan, the colleague and teacher of Fromm Reichman, presented a highly complex contemplation on the nature of self called, quote, "the illusion of personal individuality," unquote, and concluded that one's conviction in a unique identity is the mother of all illusions. When Fromm Reichman began to witness
a stream of exchanges and interchanges with her patients, she tried to cross a bridge to those who were out of contact by sheer empathic willpower. She explored her own loneliness and in it found a source of energy to transform it patiently into new levels of communication. A work of her student Harold Searles took this development further by his demonstrations that countertransference, the therapist's personal neurotic response to the patient's projections upon him or her, and usually considered an obstruction to the course of psychotherapy, was itself a most special means one has to create a bridge to those who are out of contact. For example, quote, "It is equally important that the therapist become able to accept his nursing infant fantasies toward the patient, whether female or male, for otherwise the patient cannot learn deeply to accept his own desires to nurture the primeval basis of all givingness," unquote. There is a dimension to our life in which we live in a continuous symbiotic relationship to our world and to others. Most of what occurs when we are together happens in an invisible relationship between us, in a substratum of consciousness evolved in earliest infancy, and although seemingly superseded by other realities, this freedom of interchange remains open and functional. Searles has called attention to how this symbiotic level of relatedness occurs during various oscillating phases of intensive psychotherapy, moving from a merging love and caring of full symbiosis to a reluctant and painful acceptance of the full range of emotions in the phase of ambivalent symbiosis, and so on. These phases also manifest clearly in any intimate long-term relationship, and sometimes even in the briefest but most meaningful encounters. Our preoccupation with the uniqueness of our own so precious identity is a, quote, defense against one's unconscious fear of recognizing that human existence is lived largely at a symbiotic level, unquote, of which we are only subliminally aware, but which is nevertheless our, quote, most sensitive and reliable organ for perceiving the world, not merely by mirroring a world set at some distance, but through processes of interjection and projection, literally sampling, literally mingling with, in manageable increments, the world through which moment by changing moment one moves, unquote. What I have tried to describe in the preceding few pages is a particular expression of compassion as it has developed in the apparently esoteric discipline of intensive psychotherapy with people in extreme states of mind. Although psychotherapy itself may be on the verge of extinction, the experience of compassion and the impulse of to cultivate its expression always remains as a basic element of our human nature. So it has always been understood, practiced, and experienced within the Buddhist meditation tradition that, quote, exchanging oneself for others, unquote, is the quickest and most direct means to develop and fulfill our basic nature of compassion. This is made possible by taking hold of what is already there, the spontaneous ebb and flow of exchange, our natural infrastructure of compassion. We need only to seize it in the service of caring for others. Then it becomes the faultless, egoless support for anything that can be called basic attendance or psychotherapy. As the 8th century Indian teacher Santideva said, "Whoever wishes to quickly protect himself and all other beings should embrace this sacred mystery, the exchanging of oneself for others." Clarification. The ongoing relationship
of psychotherapy as a most fertile ground to practice the mind training of exchanging oneself for others. The result of that practice will necessarily manifest in insight and in the therapist's activity of speech and direct communication. There are many different forms and categories of therapist's speech, but here I will describe a particular quality of speech, a direct clinical application arising from the therapist's own mind training. Emotions, even complex ones like loneliness, are the very energy of relationships, and they provoke and motivate much of the therapist's speech. Sometimes emotions occur in conflicting pairs, and one becomes preoccupied with doubt as to which emotion is real. Sometimes emotions easily displace one another in a continual alternation. One emotion can substitute for another, or can cover up one another, cover up another one. Or one emotion can become habitually used to defend against the appearance of another, and so on. Since emotions are so fickle, mobile, inherently transient, yet always recycling, it is no wonder that they cause suffering. This is the great enigma of emotions. On one hand, they are vitality. On the other hand, they are suffering. At a less global level, there is a basic interpretation or principle that a therapist can offer about working with emotions. If one wishes to be free of painful, disturbing emotions, the only way to do it is to be equally willing to abandon pleasurable ones. The effort must be simply symmetrical. Perhaps, quote, interpretation, unquote, is not the technically correct term, yet it is a kind of interpretation about the reality of mind and emotions, about how they work. Apparently very few people come to this knowledge on their own. Although such a principle may seem commonsensical enough, conviction of its correctness and thus the effort to do it comes from mature meditation experience. It comes from discovering a potential quality of evenness, equanimity, or impartiality, such as not having a preference for good thoughts as opposed to bad thoughts, not favoring one's own concerns over the concerns of others, not valuing stillness of thoughts over a rushing flow of thoughts, or even not cherishing companionship as opposed to aloneness. All of these are expressions of a spacious mind, a largeness of mind. Such spaciousness and equanimity in oneself gradually evolve during the progressive journey of meditation. But sometimes, even at the beginning, it can appear in glimpses, as when there is not a flicker of resistance to any thought or emotion as it arises in the mind, and when a thought appears, there is no fascination to hold on to it, and so the mind is free, open, and fresh. If a therapist is to convey such an attitude of ease and non-attachment, lightness, as it was previously described, about relating to emotions, it probably goes without saying that one should not indulge in too much speculation about a particular emotion, analyzing it, looking for origins, meanings, and so on. Anything that produces further preciousness and solidification of emotions, especially when one begins to link up an emotion with memories or anticipations, the emotion becomes more solid and persistent, and its clarity obscured. Simple recognition and non-holding seem to be practical enough. Another practice and effective encounter can be called, quote, clarification, unquote, a direct meeting of minds between therapist and patient through the medium of speech. It is at once the expression of the enigma of emotions as well as the equal nature of mind, and also a bridge of understanding. It is a simple and descriptive thing to do, and as it turns out, it is quite a generous action. First, the therapist hears at more or less deep levels within himself and has a taste of the variety of emotions that a person is experiencing. At the same time, the therapist might become aware of conflicts among these emotions, which is a source of confusion and suffering for the patient. It is this conflict that the therapist first assimilates by fleetingly making it his own. That is, the therapist identifies with the patient's dilemma. He or she can, quote, feel, unquote, by means of memory or imagination, a similar situation in his or her own life. It gives rise to the same cycle of emotions. The person may be describing sudden rejection by a lover or frustration at caring for a demented parent or a futile struggle against an addiction of some kind. And the therapist might think, yes, I know that vicious cycle. So a rhythm of exchange is initiated by the therapist's willingness to accept the person's suffering as his or her own. In a similar way, the therapist is able to accept an angry person's complaints as being always genuine in some measure, always having a seed of truth in them. The therapist does not try to protect him or herself by some technical dialectic, but instead feels the person's source of frustration. Thus, a rhythm of exchange has begun, and the therapist is now able to give what is good in him or herself, such as kindness, patience, courage, or humor. Like this, the therapist precisely plays it back to the patient, often using the patient's own words and images in such a way that it clearly brings to the surface the war zone of emotions that the patient is enduring. Even if nothing of this is new to the patient, it still brings it all together in one overview. The therapist does this alone in something of a monologue, saying whatever he or she has observed about the struggle of impulses in which the patient feels trapped. In this sense, the practice of Tonglen can be translated into the interpenetrating movement of relationship, whether it be clinical or ordinary situations. This might take some time, probably using more words than the therapist usually does at any one time. It is one of those unusual times in therapy when the therapist says what is on his or her mind without any expectation of a response, and the patient simply listens to the therapist's voice more or less relaxed and with a slight sense of appreciation at the work of synthesis being attempted. It is in this act of listening that the patient can experience a complete stepping out of the conflict itself and island of clarity. It could be a straightforward description, or it could also be more creative, depending on how inspired the therapist feels. That is, it could be anything from a simple playback to an empathic tour de force. In effect, it doesn't make too much difference. The therapist takes a stand, represents, and openly speaks for, and actually identifies with, first one side, and then the other side of the conflict of opposing emotions. One does this equally judiciously, without taking sides, without any sense that one side is right or wrong, or that one side is worthier than the other. And the therapist draws no conclusion from this, nor asks the patient to draw any conclusion either. For the patient, it is just an experience of having been completely heard and felt, and that the struggle has been appreciated. In my experience, this is the most direct and effective thing a therapist could do to highlight a developing inner, quote, chasm situation, unquote, or diffuse an impending, quote, psychotic predicament, unquote. In a chasm situation, someone creates an impasse for themselves by becoming caught up in a whirlwind of mental speed and escalating thoughts. In a predicament, it becomes more and more solidified so that one can go neither forward nor backward. But in fact, many of these situations can be relaxed easily by the sense of evenness and light touch of, quote, clarification, unquote, because it communicates both openness and gentleness. The process of clarification forms itself through one's meeting with another person while one resonates sympathetically with the emotions being expressed. It requires some effort to train oneself to do this. For example, a therapist might attempt a clarification a couple of times a week just to explore it. Beyond that, as a therapist experiments with the clarification process and actually develops it as a practice, then his or her abilities of sympathetic insight begin to evolve further and more deeply. Retreat. There's a subtle dimension of loneliness that is a source of strength or power. Before loneliness disintegrates into its catastrophic form that Fromm Reichmann predicted could imbalance the mind or become the less extreme feelings of self-accusation and despair, there is a transitional state in which loneliness holds a quiet dignity. This quality can be called aloneness, or the ability to be alone, or a lack of fear at being alone. Usually when one sees this in oneself or in others, even in children, it is like a glimpse of some strength of character. When Hermann Hesse's novel Siddhartha first appeared in English in the 1950s, it seemed to open up a new vista of maturity for adolescents of the time and for successive generations. During the course of the young Siddhartha's journey through loneliness, he comes to embody the possibilities of human character strength. In his frequent repeated statements, quote, I can think, I can fast, I can wait, unquote, is the full expression of his dawning maturity. I can think means I can see clearly and precisely everything that occurs in my mind. I am not shaken or controlled by anything that arises in it. I can fast means I can endure lack of comfort or companionship. I can live simply on very little. I have forbearance for hardship and even ascetic self-discipline. I can wait means I have a sense of stillness, nakedness, naked beingness, complete in itself, a patience beyond the need for entertainment or babysitters. All of this is about the willingness to be lonely and the intention to surrender to the experience of retreat. It has always been in just this way that the sanity of loneliness has been explored and cultivated. The alchemy of transforming the suffering of loneliness into the confidence of aloneness is one of the basic tasks of becoming a full human being. Whenever you find this activity, you find the mark of a spiritual life. The catalyst to make this transformation possible has always been the hidden province of traditional cultures which preserve the skills and disciplines to guide one through the confrontation with loneliness. Universally, this is called the practice of retreat, pulling back from the complexity of world's entanglements to the simplicity of coming face to face with oneself. But the true urge to do retreat does not come from cultural or religious prescription or expectation, or from personal ambition. The spiritual tradition only provides the opportunity and energy the genuine need for a retreat comes from a lonely place within oneself that at certain moments of life calls out to us to be heard, to be met. Naked moments of being alone appear unexpectedly anywhere, at any time, as experiences of stillness, immovable. It might happen just at the end of a long and exhausting outpouring of emotion, like an emptying out, or it might happen when the deep conviction in what seemed an unbreakable friendship abruptly collapses, or when speed and a constant busyness of mind spontaneously reveal themselves as futile, or when it becomes piercingly clear that life's end is in sight. Usually these are moments of sudden hopelessness, but they are luminous nevertheless. Loneliness in search of itself is a reminder that an entire dimension of our being, something so intimate to us, remains to be acknowledged and known. But then we may have a glimpse of this and feel it to be an awesome place, better left unnoticed, or we may become distracted by so many other interesting things to do. But we may simply lack the confidence, the examples, the instructions for how to proceed. To begin, there needs to be the intention to be lonely, to do what needs to be done, to stand alone between the sky and earth, exposed, open, and valorous. This has nothing to do with surviving the elements, with visions, or with proving oneself. It is remaining steadily in one's vulnerability, able to be intimate with fear, looking into oneself, fragile, persevering, listening, waiting. Early in retreat, one may experience the loneliness of all the elements, the whole world of trees, sky, rocks, all vastly lonely, resplendent in their loneliness. Soon loneliness becomes more ordinary, cooking and cleaning, smelling and tasting food, preparing firewood, all occur in the midst of great precision. Loneliness is appreciated as elegant simplicity. A deep loneliness occurs when everything within one's mind is a rapid succession of causes and conditions, one after the other. The mind itself is empty, except for its continual magical tricks of swift appearances and disappearances. Our close friend is without real substance, hardly worth talking to anymore. We are unable to say that this aloneness has dignity. It is stripped bare of such features. We do not expect this desolation. It is a time to invoke the instructions and courage of the retreat teachers and to share in their aloneness. Obviously, it is hopeless to try and make everything come out right to create happy endings. Even the slightest move in the direction causes more confusion. There is not another being in the world to blame for it. Never has the truth of suffering been more clear, and yet it does not lead to despair or depression. It would be like getting depressed about the second law of thermodynamics. There are moments of fundamental relaxation, giving into whatever appears in the mind, but going along with none of it. Discipline takes less effort because the unique task of aloneness itself spontaneously brings one back to meditation. Somehow, this sense of ease seems worthy of celebration. Mutuality. It is a paradox yet true that the journey of uncovering basic aloneness could lead to feeling intimate with all beings. When you look around, you see the extent to which others are struggling against loneliness. You have a view of the suffering in front of them. When the despair of loneliness is transformed or purified, we could say, into the heroism of aloneness, it becomes a reservoir of energy that makes exchanging oneself for others possible, and without knowing it, one's innate compassionate nature flourishes. From that, a suppleness of intelligence develops. One spontaneously sees what is needed to reduce the suffering of others and creatively knows the practical steps to take. The activity called basic attendance is one such natural outcome. Perhaps every attentive parent has experiences of this instinct. My father despairingly witnessed the unfathomable difficulties of my early years in school. Until the age of 9, I seemed unable to learn, had difficulty reading, and usually felt humiliated and isolated by failure. At one point, he either understood what was the problem or just decided to comfort and explore it in a personal way. In any case, it was an act of simple basic attendance, intuition, and skill. His medical office on the first floor of our home allowed him to come and go to the family residence between seeing patients or whenever he had a break. It did not seem to be any real plan or strategy on his part. One day he just started doing it. While I was seated at my desk, supposedly doing my homework after dinner, he came in, sat down next to the desk facing me, and started reading to himself from a large medical book he had brought with him. I was quite surprised. He was just being there, studying alongside me. He did this a couple times each evening for weeks, maybe months. After 10 minutes or sometimes 30 minutes, he would leave and go back to work. We did not talk much, but just sat there doing our mutual studies. He said this was an opportunity for him to do some reading, which he had no time to do. Sometimes he would doze off from fatigue. As soon as these visitations began, I was thrown face to face with my problem. In fact, I had never before stayed still at my desk, nor had I ever attempted to control my almost constant restlessness, distraction, and frustration. Now I was stuck with it, but when he sat with me, I tried not to move too much and just confronted my inability to concentrate. A sense of discipline appeared. I realized what I had to work with, and very gradually I learned to hold my seat, just as he did, and I became a proper student. Sometimes, to this day, when my mind wanders erratically, an ineffable sense of presence and stability arises in the midst of my loneliness. It seems inevitable that a child's first good experiences of basic attendance create a warm spot and an easy acceptance for all future experiences of basic attendance. One's openness or trust in this form of learning companionship makes it easier to enter when, in the successive phases of our life, it may become useful, skillful, or urgent. There is a freedom to enter into relationships with teachers, tutors, trainers, counselors, and spiritual elders. Thus, much of our ability to receive help from others rides on the success of our early basic attendance encounters. They are landmark events in our development, our developmental history of sanity. Whatever else may happen in basic attendance, the main point is that the principles and disciplines to stabilize body and mind are communicated. This is not done intellectually. It cannot be learned in books. It comes only from human example, human transmission, and warmth. This occurs at different levels at the same time when the natural flow of interpenetration, being guided by exchanging oneself for others, and a full appreciation of symbiotic relatedness function together. Perhaps this makes less mysterious the plea by Harold Searles that psychotherapists, as they become more personally familiar with the inevitability of death, might have the courage to work more deeply with elderly persons. Quote, we shall be encouraged to enter into such work, for example, in proportion as we become convinced that even a single moment of deeply felt intrapersonal and interpersonal relatedness is subjectively timeless, eternal, and makes up for several decades of living as a less than whole person, unquote. In the very specialized form of therapy of working intimately with disturbed people, the lineage of Frieda Fromm Reichman, Harold Searles, and others attempted to explore the capabilities for the human transmission of sanity to its full extent. Fundamental to all their discoveries is the living principle that such unique human relationships are, from beginning to end, a mutual discovery between therapist and patient, a mutual journey of becoming free from personal madness. Here is one way that has been expressed. Quote, if the author were a dying patient, and in psychotherapy, the greatest service a therapist could render him would be beyond helping him to face the fact of his own coming death, that of giving him to know that the relationship was also being of use to the therapist in his own adjustment to the death, which will inevitably come to him as it is coming sooner now to the dying patient, unquote. We have come full circle. At first, the wonder and energy of psychoanalysis passed into the discipline of psychotherapy, and now it returns while retaining its original inspiration in the form of basic attendance. In this way, the original intention and brilliance of intimate human caring is capable of entering into the domains of childcare, education, the elderly, and the dying, and gives all human services in general a more profound dimension.